From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and directors. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival and Conference and at our year-round events. On today's episode, actress and producer America Ferrara.
Everywhere we went, no matter race, gender, age, people were saying about my character, who is a 16-year-old Mexican-American girl, that's me, that's me, that's me.
And later in our program, theater, film, and television actress June Squibb.
Take the Nebraska script. Now, when you read that you go to the cemetery and lift your skirts and why and the words that were used and everything, that's juicy. I mean, that's great.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. America Ferrara is best known for her work on the ABC comedy drama Ugly Betty. The role garnered her a Golden Globe, a Screen Actors Guild Award, and a Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series. America Ferrara's numerous film credits include Real Women Have Curves, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, End of Watch, and How to Train Your Dragon. America Ferrara returned to television in 2015 as a regular and co-producer on the NBC comedy Superstore. Marcy Mayhorn spoke with America Ferrara in 2012 at the 19th Austin Film Festival.
I'm the youngest of six children. My mother was a single mother. We were financially strapped, and I guess I would say that I understood that I enjoyed acting, performing by the time I was about 8 years old. And I grew up, I lived in Los Angeles, but 30 miles outside of LA proper, and ideologically as far away from Hollywood as I possibly could be. But I grew up acting in theater, in school, in community theater. I just did it everywhere and anywhere I could. My very first role, I tagged along with my sisters to their auditions for Romeo and Juliet at the junior high. They were like, fine, but don't say anything and sit in the back. And then I found my way to the director, Mr. Protho, and asked if I could audition. And he handed me an audition sheet. And I got up on stage. And I mean, I was in third grade, reading Shakespeare for the first time. So I couldn't have been anything short of awful. And he cast me as the apothecary in Romeo and Juliet. So I think it was like the sight gag. He liked seeing like a third grader this tall as the apothecary. And I loved it. I mean, I really, really, really can remember the feeling of being on stage for the first time and just feeling like I love this, you know. And I did it just in school and in community theater. You know, it's hard in Los Angeles because you're so oversaturated with this casting call or this cattle call or this, you know, this program where just pay us $10,000 and we'll get you headshots and an agent. And luckily, we didn't have any money to give away. Professionally, I was in high school in my drama class, and a woman came over from Studio City, and she said that there would be a workshop where she'd teach you how to audition for commercials, and at the end, there would be a showcase, and there would be agents there. So I did it, and I waitressed to pay for the class, and at the end of it, I got signed. It was with them that I found my first job, which was a Disney Channel movie called Gotta Kick It Up. And it was a dance movie, and it was like the best first job ever. I was 17. And then shortly after that, HBO came around. They were making Real Women Have Curves, and they needed a 17-year-old Mexican-American, you know, very particular type of person. And it wasn't something that was abundantly found in Hollywood. So with Real Women Have Curves, I had just finished Gotta Kick It Up, and I finally had enough money to go to drama camp, which was my biggest dream ever. So I went to drama camp at Northwestern University, And 3 weeks in, my manager calls me, the woman who taught the commercial workshop all of a sudden became a manager. My manager, I was her only client. She calls me and she says, they're auditioning for this HBO movie. They want to see you. Will you come back? And I was like, no, I'm at drama camp. Like, I waited my whole life to be at drama camp. And she's like, well, I really think you should. I was like, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm not back for another 3 weeks. So, you know, if they want to see me when I get back, that's fine. She was like, okay. She calls me back and was like, can you put yourself on tape? I was like, okay. So my roommate helped me put myself on tape. And then she called back after. They said, okay, they liked your tape. Now they really want you to come back out. I'm like, I am at, what part of this don't you understand? I am at drama camp. It is my dream come true to be here. HBO can go like I'm at drama camp. So she was really mad at me. And she's like, fine, well, they said that if they haven't found her by the time, you know, you're done with drama camp, they'll see you, but they might find someone. I was like, okay, that's fine. So I just finished drama camp. And I went back and they hadn't found someone. They called me and I auditioned with Lupe Ontiveros, who played my mother, who just passed away this year. And then I auditioned with several women who were to play my sister. And then I auditioned with a bunch of guys. And they were auditioning other girls, like doing a bunch of chemistry reads. So it was a long audition process. And then finally I got it. And we shot that in September 2001. Actually, our very first day of rehearsal was on September 11th, 2001. And then by January of 2002, we were premiering at the Sundance Film Festival. So I had gone from never having worked as an actor in April of 2001 to being at the Sundance Film Festival at January 2002. And the film was very well received. And that's really what opened up all the doors for me in my career.
I remember after we saw the film, I remember, like I said, watching it on HBO and then slowly kind of realizing how big that role was. I mean, the role of Patricia was such a flawed character, but at the same time so strong, and that it really inspired a lot of young women of all cultures because of her drive and determination. Did you anticipate how big this was going to be or the praise that it was going to get?
No, I really had no concept of that, you know, at that age and knowing so little about the industry. You know, it's funny to me because I always say, and I mean this, I never realized how Latina I was until I started acting, you know, so I started auditioning. One of my very first auditions was for like a cable commercial, like a commercial for Comcast or something. And I did the audition and then they're like, could you sound more Latina? Could you do it with like an accent? I was like, but I don't know. Like, this is how I talk. I don't know what you're talking about. And so they wanted me to speak in broken English, basically, at 16. And I was so really confused by that. And I thought, but I'm Latina and this is how I talk. So why is this a problem? Why can't I just talk the way I talk? Why do you need me to sound like I don't understand English? So it was a big process really figuring out what other people saw when I walked into the room, and then ultimately really just not giving a shit what people saw when I walked into the room. But with Real Women Have Curves, when I read that script, I just related to it on such a personal, I mean, deep level of, you know, no, my mom didn't work in a factory, but the mother-daughter relationship really resounded with me, especially the stuff around body image and weight. So it just felt really natural to me. I had no idea at that point how it would connect to audiences. And what was so exciting about that movie when it came out was that we traveled the world with that film. We went to film festivals everywhere, and everywhere we went, no matter race, gender, age, people were saying about my character, who is a 16-year-old Mexican-American girl, that's me, that's me, that's me. I had a, you know, 50-year-old white men coming up to me and saying, that's me, like crying after the... So it was really a lesson in how, for me, the more specific a story is, the more universal it can actually be. And realizing that they could connect to me not just by what I looked like, but what the human experience was. After Real Women Have Curves, I went to college. I went to USC to study international relations. Not theater or film, but I did end up doing a number of student films. Couldn't escape it. I worked through college. I did a number of independent films, and then I did the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants movie. And then right at the end of college, I decided to do a semester in New York at NYU, and I was doing a play off-Broadway. A year before Betty actually came around, I'd heard about it. My agent had told me about it. She said, Selma Hayek's producing the show. It's based on this TV show that was in Columbia. I'd never heard of it. And then a few months later, ran into Selma Hayek at a hotel in Los Angeles, and she was leaving, and I was coming in, and she stops and just in the middle of the lobby pitches the show to me. And I hadn't heard of Betty LaFea, and I hadn't even read the script, but just from her explanation of who this character was, you know, this smart, driven, kind, hardworking woman enters this backstabbing, as superficial world as she possibly can, and yet she stays above it all. And I remember just hearing her version, which is much better than what I just said, of that. And something just switched in me. And I really, really didn't ever think I was going to do television. I didn't want it to interrupt, like, my education. And I, you know, was young. I was like, I don't want to settle down. And I want to travel. I don't want to do TV. I want to do. And I had turned down pilot offers before because I just thought TV is not what I want to do. But when I heard that setup, I don't know. I just, in me, something switched. And I thought, I wish I had that TV show to watch when I was a kid. Like, I would have run home to watch that show. And it sounded like nothing that was on TV. Prior to that, the pilots I'd gone out for and had been offered had all been some version of a crime drama, some detective. And this sounded new and fresh and like it hadn't been seen or done before. About almost another year went by before the script came around. And I was in New York doing my off-Broadway play and finishing up a semester at NYU. And they didn't offer me the role. You know, Selma wanted me to do it and her producing partner, but the network said, well, she has to read for it. So I went in and did a camera test, and I really just had that attitude of like, they have two choices. They can cast me and have a show, or they cannot cast me and do it wrong. Like, that was really my attitude. And that's sort of how I felt about Real Women Have Curves, too. I mean, I know it sounds really arrogant saying it out loud, but the things that I've done and that I've had so much pride in and have sort of become what I imagined them to be in my mind were the things that from the very first moment I knew it was right. I knew that I was the person to step into that part. And I walked into those auditions without apology, without feeling like, I'm sorry, I'm maybe 85% of what you want, but I'll, you know, try and do enough of a song and a dance so you don't realize the other 25%. Like, those auditions never go well. I never get those parts. It's the roles that I know on instinct I'm meant to do that. And I know that I have what it takes. And that's what it felt like with Ugly Betty. So I went in and I did my screen test and then they offered it to me. And then I did the show.
On Story is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story will be back with more of actress and producer America Ferrara in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with actress and producer America Ferrara speaking with Marcy Mayhorn in 2012 at the 19th Austin Film Festival.
I'm curious how, with Ugly Betty, how involved were you then once you got on board in the writing process or the development process of the character?
Yeah. The foundation for the work that I have done as a producer came from that show. I learned so much being on television, and because it's so immediate, you're having kind of an immediate conversation with your work all the time. You do it, you see it, you go back to the drawing board. You do it, you see it, you go back to the drawing board, and you're having these conversations with your creative team all the time, and getting now more than ever to get responses, not just from yourself and your creative team, but from your audience. So 4 years of that, like, it was like a boot camp producing workshop. And I was never a producer in an official capacity on the show, but I was very deeply involved in the way that the show developed, the way the stories rolled out, where that character went, where that character ended. And, you know, I was in the writing room probably a lot more than the writers wanted me in the writing room.
It sounds like all of your roles, like you were saying, have really been a big role model for young girls. And I'm curious, though, with the writing process, were there ever any challenges or things that came up that were a struggle for the character? It always seems like it's a flawless role for you, but I was just wondering if there were any, was ever a time where it was like, wow, this is a real challenger. I don't know how I can relate to this character at this moment.
I don't know if there were moments where I felt like I couldn't relate. I felt like there were moments where it was a struggle sometimes to fight for the character's growth when you're doing network TV and you have network executives and creatives who are afraid to lose an audience. You know, it's because I had so much faith in the character and faith that the audience understood what I was doing with the character and who this character was. I thought, we can have Betty do something that's not morally right, and we're not going to lose, they're not going to all just tune out. We can make her more complex. We can make her more interesting. We can ask her to do the wrong thing and then talk about that and not have to have her just be a saint, because that's the only way people will watch. So I did feel like there were times where I was in those conversations with the team just about how far we could push the envelope and how far we could go, and to trust that our audience was going to stay in it with us.
I'm sure most of you are familiar then with your not only starring in but also being a producer on Ryan Pierce Williams' The Dry Land. I'm just curious how the involvement with that project began too, and now kind of going from not only actor in the film but then playing again a role in the development and creativity of that.
Yeah. Well, that was an incredibly sort of natural process, because Ryan Pierce Williams is my husband and he wrote that in our home. So I was reading every draft, you know, as the scenes were being done, I was reading them and giving him thoughts creatively from the very beginning. And I never in a way of, oh, I'm going to go on to produce this, just as a sounding board. And then when the script came together, which I think he sat and wrote it for about a year, even though it was many years in the researching process before he sat down to write it, I'd been through all those stages with him. So by the time it came to, you know, putting it together and finding the financiers and finding the cast, and, you know, I really realized that it was a really exciting role to be in, to really get to be the sort of mirror for the visionary. You know, film is a director's medium, and to help him come to his vision by being the person who reminds him what that vision was back a year ago when we were talking. You know, I think as filmmakers, there are a lot of compromises that have to be made to get your movie done. And I think it's incredibly important to be surrounded by one or two people who can, yes, help you make those compromises, but also not let you get off track with what you originally started out to do. And so for me, it was fun to get to be that part for him, all the way from writing it, to financing it, to casting it, to shooting it, to editing it, and then marketing it, and then traveling the country and other parts of the world with the film. When you're there for every step of the process, you get to kind of be one of the linchpins of what the director's vision of it is. And that was a really exciting process for me, and I loved being a producer, and so I continued to find ways to to be that person in that role. You have to support and stick to one person's vision, you know? And I think I learned that in TV as well. I mean, with Ugly Betty, I learned that the longevity of a show and a show making sense in the long run and keeping an audience and staying true to what it is, even when it is growing and changing, really has to be based on a very strong backbone, a very strong vision. You know, I think you look at what's on TV and what works and what's making sense, and you look at what cable's doing, and they're investing in creators, the creative people behind the vision. And I think this TV by committee or filmmaking by committee can get really messy. You want the one person whose vision it is, and then you want the people surrounding that person to protect the integrity of that vision.
In college, a friend of mine passed off one of the plays, Dog Sees God, and was like, oh, you should read this. It's a really good play. Okay. So I remember thumbing through the front of the book and seeing the original cast and seeing your name on there and thinking, oh, my God, like this is, and then realizing which role you played and thinking that it was astounding, and I wish I could have seen that. And I know, of course, you recently played Roxy Hart in Chicago and London last year, and it sounds like, from what I've heard, that you do have some new theater works coming up on the horizon. So I'm just curious if you could talk about your experience in theater versus film and television, because, I mean, obviously, you know, there's two different mediums there. You know, what have those experiences contributed towards your film career just in general?
Well, like I said, I grew up doing theater in school, community theater. So doing theater for me is what feels actually the most natural. I feel like when I go back to theater, I get to revisit how I started. And with theater, it's a completely different discipline. You know, I'm not saying one is harder than the other. I think all of them have their enormous challenges, and I enjoy them all in very different ways. But when it comes to theater, you know, there's something very psychological about having to show up every day and do the exact same role with the exact same lines and play the exact same character in the same performance with that cast, and it can really drive you crazy, can drive you insane. And so finding a certain neutral balance inside of yourself to be able to get yourself to where you need to go at the same time every day, it's a little bit like a meditation in a way. And for me, I feel like I love being on stage, and you get something by being on stage that you don't get any other way, which is this immediacy of the audience. And that's another sensation as a performer that you just won't get anywhere else.
What do you do to prepare? You know, obviously I know you're drawn to a role based on the substance that's there, but what do you do to really prepare for those roles and jump into them?
Yeah, as I've said 100 times, I don't have any training as an actor. When I started working, I just had my experience in public high school theater and community theater and just instinct. That's all I had. And that was fine to a certain point, but then I really did feel like I needed tools. And I started seeking out classes, coaches, methods, you know, books and workshops that could help me in that process. I think that in this industry, no matter what role you're playing, actor, producer, director, writer, you need to constantly be sharpening your tools and finding ways to stay on top of yourself creatively and not let yourself get creatively lazy. So for me, my education as an actor has come sort of trial by fire, being thrown in there and finding ways and tools that could help me get through it. So every role is a little bit of a different preparation process. And End of Watch was a really, really special process because, I mean, we got to go on ride-alongs with police officers. And I remember the very first day of preparation for that film, we went to the academy, and the first thing they had us do was close our eyes and listen to real 911 calls, domestic calls, and just put us in that place immediately of like what this world was that we were stepping into. And I was terrified of this role. They'd originally asked me to read the script and come in to play a different character, not one of the cops. And when I read the script, I thought, well, I could do that, and it wouldn't be much of a stretch for me to play that character. But to play that character would be like digging into a whole part of my emotional, physical, psychological strength that I haven't had to do yet. And that's why I chose, I didn't choose, I went in and asked the director if he would consider letting me play that part. And I think he was really shocked and then said yes. Then I was terrified because I then thought, oh my gosh, he said yes, and now I have to do it. And second of all, I don't want to let him down, and I don't want to be an incredible disappointment. And how am I going to find the strength? I don't know if I can be that character. I don't know if I can be that strong. And so I threw myself in as much as I could. And it was one of those experiences where when you look back, you think, oh yeah, and then we made a movie, because it was really the researching the role and stepping into that part that I remember, and that experience was so intense. And it is one of those experiences that changes you. And I will say that The Dry Land that Ryan wrote and directed, you know, that is centers around a soldier who comes from the war in Iraq and tries to reintegrate into his life with the symptoms of PTSD and just trying to get back to normal life. And in that creative process, we spoke to countless amounts of soldiers and wives of soldiers, and we traveled all over the country with that film and screened it for soldiers who had just come back from the war or were just going to the war, and had these conversations and Q&As. And we actually went to Iraq. We went on a USO tour to Iraq and met at least 1,000 soldiers who we spoke to. And those are the sorts of experiences where it's just, that changes you as a person. I had a really interesting experience when I went into college. I had shot those first two films, the Disney Channel movie and Real Women Have Curves. And, you know, to be honest, my goals at that stage in my life were just to be as successful as an actress as I could be. I wanted to be famous, and I wanted to make money, and I wanted to do what I loved. And I had absolutely no charitable intentions whatsoever. But then I went to college and I studied international relations, and I was learning about, you know, I grew up in the Valley and I went to public schools. And so I was a straight A student and at the top of my class, but I wasn't the most informed person in the world. So when I started school, I was shocked and embarrassed and ashamed of how little I knew about the world that I lived in. And as I was learning about things happening in the world that I'd never been exposed to, I started feeling this enormous amount of pressure and fear that I had chosen to do something with my life that was so selfish when there were really real problems happening in the world. And why wouldn't I dedicate my life to being of value to those real problems instead of just going over here and doing what I love and make movies? I mean, how much does that impact changing these issues? And I went to one of my professors and I shared this with him at the end of my first semester. And I said, I'm really scared and I feel like I have to stop acting and do something useful with my life. And he was a like mid-60s white man, gray hair, had no idea he even knew my name. I just approached him in his office hours. And he sat there and told me that he had mentored a young Latina girl from the area for years, and that she really never liked him for 3 years, never really trusted him, never really opened up to him. And then one day she goes to him and says, do you really want to know what my life is like? And he's like, yes. And she said, well, then come watch this movie with me. It's called Real Women Have Curves. He took her and her friends to go see this movie, and then took him to a cafe, and that they sat there for hours kind of laughing and crying and discussing how they'd never felt like their struggle had been seen on film before. And then they took that, he went, bought the DVD, showed it to her family. Then they sat and they talked about how her family might support her wanting to go to college instead of what they had been doing, which is telling her that it was not an option and that it was selfish for her to want to go to college because the family needed her to make money, and that an education wasn't going to help them in the immediate sense. And so he shared that story with me and really wanted me to understand that if I so chose to make my career not about saving the world, but about things that actually connected on a human level, that there could be an impact. And I started shifting in my mind this idea of a successful career to an actual meaningful career. And that didn't mean everything I did had to have a message. I think that what I learned, again, through Real Women Have Curves was if it connected on a deep human level in me, chances were it was going to connect on that deep human level to millions of other people. So staying true and hearing your own voice and being as honest as you can with what is my unique experience, as painful as it might be, as vulnerable as it might be, to open those wounds and share that, that's what actually has the power to impact people on a very individual basis. And so that was a moment when I realized, oh, I didn't have to give up acting to do something important in the world. I could commit myself to acting and to having a career that was meaningful at the very least to me, which might make it meaningful to other people. And my goals didn't have to be fame and money. And I never imagined that my education would be as much use to me in my career as it has been, which, you know, I've, with my education, have felt confident enough to do things like, you know, get involved politically, campaign. This year I've been doing work with a nonpartisan organization, Voto Latino, to mobilize the Latino vote around the country because there's so much kind of latent political potential in the Latino communities and are going to be a huge factor in this election. And also being able to use whatever platform I have as an actor to bring attention to things that I really care about. And Half the Sky is a documentary that just aired on PBS that is based on a book. And I read this book and was moved beyond, you know, anything I'd ever felt reading a book before, and wanted to be a part of the solution, and then was asked to be a part of the documentary. And it really is not just a movie, it's a movement. And that's really exciting, to get to use your passion for something that is actually making a big, big difference in people's lives. You know, I don't pick every role thinking like, well, what does this say about Latinas? And what does this say about women? And I pick my roles on what stirs me creatively, but I do make sure that it's not something I'm doing, you know, for goals that are incredibly superficial, like the ones I had when I was a 17-year-old girl. Honestly, I feel like my only hope is that, you know, that I can give a performance that someone else can connect to on a human level, no matter if you're a man or a woman, or if you're young or old, or what your racial or your religious or your, you know, political backgrounds are. I believe that what we do as storytellers is we bring each other closer. I think that that's what storytelling is about. It's about making this big world with so many labels and boxes and differences, and doing away with those by sharing what is common, what is human, what does bring us together and make us the same. And so for me as an actor, I feel excited by going into a role that's incredibly specific, and in that specificity, you know, can break through those boundaries and those barriers to make someone who maybe has no idea what it's like to be a cop, or has no idea what it feels like to work in a magazine industry, or to be a Hispanic woman, or any of whatever the labels of that role are, and be able to let someone sit and watch it and feel like they connect to what the human experience is. And I feel like as an actor, that is always just my number one goal, is how do I tap into the human experience?
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International, we'll be back with actress June Squibb in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Actress June Squibb got her start in musical theater in the 1950s. She made her Broadway debut as Electra in the original 1960 production of Gypsy, starring Ethel Merman. June Squibb made her transition to film in the late 1980s with Woody Allen's Alice and went on to roles in Scent of a Woman, The Age of Innocence, Meet Joe Black, and Far From Heaven. She's since worked twice with director Alexander Payne, first on the film About Schmidt, and later co-starring with Bruce Dern in Nebraska, which earned her the Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. Her recent credits include the critically acclaimed film I'll See You in My Dreams with Rhea Perlman, Mary-Kate Place, and Sam Elliott, as well as television appearances in Getting On, Girls, Glee, The Big Bang Theory, and Modern Family. June Squibb spoke with journalist Jane Sumner at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
I started doing film in New York. It probably was 89, 90. And it was a period when a lot of films were being done in New York. And a lot of theater people were getting roles because they were there. So I just simply, you know, decided, well, this is silly. I should be doing this too. So I truly went to my agent, and he got the audition for me. He made an effort because I said I wanted to do it. And they were roles, they were small roles, but they were roles that were noticed. It was funny because even before I left New York, I became a film actress. And that's basically what I was doing there. About Schmidt was made while I was living in New York. But before, I mean, the only thing I knew was theater. And I worked on Broadway, off Broadway, did cabaret, did cruises, singing and dancing on cruises. I did a lot of musicals. And of course now it's really, I just seem to be doing all film and television.
You were a sweet little old lady in About Schmidt,
yeah.
So I have heard that Payne was not sure you were ready to play a
Nebraska
feisty plainswoman.
Well, it's really kind of an interesting story because with About Schmidt, he was in L.A. and I was in New York, and my agent kept saying, see her, tape her, do something. And they kept saying, no, 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 we're going to cast it in L.A. And, you know, he doesn't want to see. Well, he couldn't find what he wanted. So finally, they put me on tape in New York. He told me this later. He said, you were it. And the minute they saw the tape, but it took, I cannot tell you, about a half a year for them to finally decide they would consider me. And then the same thing happened with Nebraska. He was seeing every woman of a certain age in New York and L.A. and I don't know where else. And my agents kept calling and he kept saying, we love June. You know we love June, but she's not right for this. She's not right for this at all. Well, again, he couldn't find what he wanted. And so they called me. I was in New York and they wanted to see me. He wanted to see me in L.A., I was working in New York, so I taped again. And again, the minute he got the tape, he called me back and said, well, you're doing it. So what can we say? It's so ridiculous that in both, it was just such a fluke that I even, you know, was doing either one of them. I start with a script, and I read it a lot. And I think with Nebraska, I learned it and then worked on each scene as we shot it. But I do a lot of work, a lot of reading and thinking of, you know, who this person is. I don't necessarily plot stuff, and that is my training as well, so that I'm reacting, you know, to both the other actor and what the director's asking.
I know some of the reporters who interviewed you after Nebraska said, well, she's really very sweet. And she has a lovely, soft voice. And so I have read that you modeled that character a little bit after some people you knew.
My mother, yes. That, and she is not was not with us when Nebraska opened and all this started. But in truth, there is so much of that woman is my mother.
Well, Payne says your audition knocked his socks off.
Yeah, he told me that. And I did it two different ways, and only because if you're not with them, if you're not in the room with them and able to do two or three different, you know, versions of it, then they don't know. So I did it two different ways. Well, that just thrilled him. He told me right away which one he wanted, and it was the juicier one. It really was. So that was, I think, a part of my getting the role.
Could you tell us how Payne works with actors and how you work with Payne?
He and I work a certain way. After I know it and we've started shooting a scene, and it's sort of, we do what he thinks it should be and then what I think it should be. And then he just starts throwing out words at me. You know, like faster, 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 faster. I mean, something like that. Or harsh, harsh. I want harsh. But it's like bup, 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 bup. And you don't have a chance to think. So you just sort of react immediately to what he's saying, the words that he's saying to you.
Now, you have a friend, Margot Martindale, and she had the script and said... She just wasn't right for it, so she wanted...
That was Nebraska, yes. Alexander had worked with Margot in that Paris short film thing he did, and he used to talk to me about her because he knew I knew her, in about Schmidt. He said, I haven't worked with her, but I really want to. He sent her the script of Nebraska, and then this was about a year or so before it was done or even casting on it. And we lived next door to each other in New York. And she said, June, I got this script from Alexander, and I shouldn't be doing it. It's not right for me. Nothing is right. And she said, you're perfectly right for it. Well, she was the only one that thought that at the time. You know, and I didn't know what to do. I think I called my agent, and they said, well, there's nothing about it. I mean, we can't call the office because they're not casting yet. So it was real early, and I didn't even read it. I just felt that was a no-no, you know, to take the script and read it when he hadn't sent it to me. But I was aware of the film, and one person thought I should do it. I have to tell you, that cemetery scene where I lift the skirt, that was the first thing we shot. And I even said to Alexander, I said, why are you doing this first? It's the hardest thing. I felt it was hard to do. And he said, oh, we'll just do it and get it over with. And that was his attitude, and we did. Once I had done it, then I sort of realized, oh, my, that was wild, you know.
Well, you're a really brave actress. I know I just reviewed Linda Gray's book, The Road to Happiness is Always Under Construction. And in that, she talks about at age 61, she went to London to play Mrs. Robinson, and she had a nude scene. But you, in... in Getting On, had a nude scene.
I did a nude scene.
Which takes real guts.
Well, I guess it does, but it was done very tastefully, I thought. But then I find out when I saw it, you could see one whole side all the way down, just as nude as can be. It's a very wonderful script. Two guys that also did Big Love did this, and they're the runners, and they're not the directors, but they're you know, have complete control of it. And they did the nude scene the second year. The first year, I did a segment for them, and it's the same character. And I just shot something a few months ago, their third season, and I did something there. So they've carried this character over for 3 years. But the second year, the director called me up, and he was sort of fidgeting about talking to me, and I knew there was something going on. And I said, Howie, do you want to ask me something? And he said, we want you to do a nude scene. And I said, sure. So we did. And they were all more worried about it than I was. All the cast were trying to cover me with towels and everything. And I think, you know, I danced for years when I was doing musicals. And, you know, when you do that and you're backstage with all the stagehands running around and you're changing your clothes, it begins not to mean too much, you know, that you're nude or that somebody's nude. So that was kind of where I was coming from.
I just interviewed Patricia Arquette, and she said after she won the Oscar, people thought she should make another movie, and instead she went into TV, and that was, they were critical of her for that. But she said, you go where the material is.
It's faster. I prefer film because television is faster, but you can do some great things. I mean, you get great scripts, and I just think getting on is the scripts, the directing I've had in it, everything is just A. And you don't always get that in film. You know, we're really in a, what is the word, an era of great TV. So I just feel like, you know, well, you're a part of that.
In Nebraska, you refer to Mrs. Hunsucker, mm-hmm. and that was your character in?
In A Scent of a Woman. That was Al Pacino. And it was full of young men, and it was Philip Seymour Hoffman, his first big role. I think he might have done one or two independent films before that. And Chris O'Donnell, who's on NCSI LA. And it was fun. It was great. And the guys used to kid me, and they were always yelling, Hunsucker, at me all the time. And that's not very interesting, but it was funny at the time.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We've been hearing from theater, film, and television actress June Squibb on this half of our program. Her career spans more than six decades, having started out in musical theater at the Cleveland Playhouse in the 1950s. We continue our segment with June Squibb, discussing her views on working with women and the gender gap in Hollywood, as well as her approach and technique when taking on a character, and words of advice for emerging actors.
Well, I love working with women. I love working with Lena. I had done one of her girls, and that's how we got to know each other. And the director of Love the Coopers is a woman, Jessie Nelson. And this is what I'm saying, everybody in L.A. is talking about this. You know, every time you read a script, not always, but for the most part, there's two women and about 10 or 15 men. And that's not what it's like when you go out on the street, you know. I mean, it's just not reality. But again, I just, you know, I hope we can make a difference. And I think that if things continue the way they are, I think it will. There's no reason for it not to. It's open. You know, it's all been opened up now, and people are talking. A wonderful teacher, Bobby Lewis, told me, write down everything, whatever you write, forget, and you just start over again. So you're not beholden to any of this stuff that you write or think or anything, you know. I think that's where some actors get into trouble, because they've written it or they've thought it, and so it has to be done that way, or with that in mind. I will do a backstory if it's very involved and a character that is a little foreign to me, something that I don't really understand that well, or a person that is really sort of far from who I am. So mine is, if I feel I need it, I do it. I'm from the Midwest, so if I get something from the Midwest, I feel I really know who this person is, and that was a part of Nebraska. I did not do a backstory for her. I mean, truly, you know, when we get scripts, and I've had so many people say this too, you know, it truly is the writing. I mean, you have nothing else to go, unless you know the director or know a producer or something like this, and you feel, well, I'll go because I trust them. But everything is the writing. And if a writer gives me interesting things in the character, then that makes me want to do it. They can even be things that seem far out, because they don't always have to end up that far out when you're working on them. I don't know, it's like, well, take the Nebraska script. Now, when you read that you go to the cemetery and lift your skirts and why and the words that were used and everything, that's juicy. I mean, that's great. And it makes you think, wow, you know, this is something you can play, that you can work on. So I think that making a character as rich in many ways as you can, is that's what always interests me. But you also get some wonderful stuff when it all goes to hell and everybody's just, you know, riffing back and forth. So if it's good, it works, then fine. If it doesn't, then that's a bad thing. It's difficult. If you don't have people that really know what they're doing, then I think you lose a lot of time because you can't use it. And even, I think, with sometimes with really good people who know how to do that, you lose time because, again, you can't use it. I think you can use such a small part of that. I loved, you know, like working with Alexander. And that was someone who just was willing to try anything. And I guess I like that. And as I said, my training is such that I don't plot anything. I don't make any decisions about what I'm going to do. It just happens there with the other actor and with the director. I do like a director who will see where I am, see where I'm going, and then talk to me from there. It upsets me if I'm obviously going somewhere and the director doesn't see it. You know, and I feel, well, what am I doing here, sort of spinning my wheels. But if a director sees where I am and then will come in and, you know, talk about it, or make decisions or, you know, tell me other ways of doing it. That's really basically where I think I'm at my best. A person who can tell me, you know, try this, try that. So I'm investigating, but I'm not pushing things. You just got to keep at it. I mean, if you know this is what you want, you know, whether it's writing or directing, it's all so hard, and we know it's hard. It's hard to get, you know, your product seen. It's hard to get it work. You know, it's really hard. I think, strangely enough, I do think health is very important to all of us because I have seen it destroy acting careers. And not just the brain, you know, where you can't remember things, but the physical, you know, the physical health. I think that that's something we all have to deal with.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.